Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator Bernie Sanders, who today, along with Senators Blumenthal and Nelson, announced legislation that would end the excessive speculation that is driving up the price of gas and food. Then we'll go to Athens, Greece, where massive street demonstrations are challenging a shaky government trying to introduce austerity measures mandated by their creditors in the European Union, who are beginning to doubt their loans will ever be paid back. An American diplomat living in Athens, John Brady Kiesling, joins us to explain the local politics, which have global implications when, not if, Greek defaults and descends into chaos. Then we will hear from a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood in North Carolina, where today state and federal funds for the nation's foremost family planning provider were stripped by the Republican legislature, making this the third state in a row to attack women's health in the name of banning abortion. Melissa Reed joins us from the Capitol in Raleigh. Then finally, we'll look into why ATF agents were told to stand aside as hundreds of guns were sold to Mexican drug cartels, with two of these guns under ATF surveillance ending up at the scene of a fatal shooting of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. Former ATF special agent Gerald Nunziato joins us. Let's now go to Senator Bernie Sanders. I'm now joined by Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the United States Senate in 2006 to represent Vermont after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He's the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and he, along with Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal, are currently sponsoring legislation that would end excessive oil speculation, driving up the price of gasoline. You met today at the press conference, I believe, not just Senator Blumenthal, but also Senator Bill Nelson of Florida joined you, along with the chairman of the Petroleum Markets Association of America, Michael Greenberger, formerly with the Commodities Future Trading Commission, and Robert Weisman, president of Public Citizen, Michael Trunzo, president and CEO of the New England Fuel Institute. Give us a brief summary, if you would, Senator Sanders, of what your legislation will offer.
Well, Ian, here is the story. Right now, all across this country, people are paying extremely high prices for gas and for oil. And the theory of why prices in the oil industry are what they are is supposed to have something to do with supply and demand. Less supply, more demand, prices go up. Well, the reality today is that we have, compared to 2 years ago, more supply, less demand, meaning prices should go down. But they have gone up very substantially over the last 2 years. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that. Number one, our friends in the oil industry, ExxonMobil and the other oil giants, continue to gouge the American people. They've made in the last 10 years almost $1 trillion in profits. But there's another element that more and more people are aware of, and that is that today the oil futures market is substantially controlled not by end users, not by people who really buy oil to use in their industry, whether it is the airline industry, whether it is trucking or fuel oil dealers. That the oil futures market is now controlled by Wall Street speculators, whose main purpose in participating in that market is to simply drive prices up, sell, and make huge profits. And according to the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago, they have been doing very, very well in making those profits. So what our legislation does is it establishes oil position limits on speculators, i.e. there will be a limit as to how much oil the speculators can control. We would double speculative margin requirements from 6% to 12%, meaning if they're going to speculate, they have to put up real money. And we would end the exemption currently given to a number of Wall Street firms who are able to appear to be end users, hedgers, rather than the speculators that they are. So those are some of what the bill does.
And in terms of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, we just learned that they're delaying regulations on derivatives, and my understanding is that Commissioner Dunn, appointed as a Democrat by George W. Bush, has been voting with the other Republicans, and I'm not sure that the CTFC is doing its job in this regard. You feel that you have to have legislation to really force their hand? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, obviously, the CFTC is not doing its job. As you've indicated, under the provision in the financial reform bill, the so-called Dodd-Frank bill, Congress required, not asked, but required them by mid-January to establish limits on speculation, on excessive speculation. They haven't done it. A number of us met with Gary Gensler, who's the chairman of the Commodities Future Trading Commission. We met with him a couple of weeks ago, and I found the meeting extremely disappointing. There was no sense of urgency on his part. They are in violation of the law, and they're just going to continue to waddle along and not do what has to be done. So essentially what this legislation does is tell them what has to be done. It will be, in effect, 2 weeks after the bill is signed, and no longer ask them to do it.
Senator Sanders, this surely points out the folly of what the Republicans are actually the mendacity of what the Republicans are suggesting vis-a-vis Elizabeth Warren. They want to take away her powers and turn her into a commission like the Commodities and Futures Trading Commission for the very reason that it's easier to control and frustrate the very mission that the Dodd-Frank bill gave it.
Well, Ian, there are a lot of issues here. I mean, one of them has to do with the fact that the American people are disenchanted with government. Here's a perfect example why. You know, the Dodd-Frank bill was not all that it should have been. In my view, it went nowhere near far enough in cracking down on Wall Street, whose greed and recklessness has caused this recession. In my own view, you got to stop breaking up these huge banks. We didn't do that. But there was some good provisions in it, and this was one of them. And it said that by mid-January 2011, you will have language that controls the amount of oil that speculators will have. And they didn't do it. They didn't do it. So, you know, clearly from the Republican perspective, they believe in deregulation. They want to let Wall Street continue to do whatever it wants to do, no matter how disastrous the results. And that mentality, that approach, has led us to where we are today, suffering through the worst recession since the Great Depression, and in the case of oil, allowing Wall Street to control 80% of the oil futures market, driving up oil prices far higher than they should be. Interestingly enough, a few weeks ago, you had the head of Exxon Mobil testifying on Capitol Hill, and he told the senator that he believed that oil prices were 40% higher than supply and demand would require because of speculation. That's the head of Rex Tillerson, the head of Exxon Mobil.
So that's 40 cents on the dollar you pay at the pump.
Probably a little bit different equation. That's for a barrel.
Right, but roughly.
But it would be a substantial increase in what you pay for a gallon of gas.
And you have to add to that the gaming and speculation in food as well.
I mean,
because it's called the Goldman Sachs Commodities Index. It's now owned by Standard & Poor's, developed by Goldman Sachs. It's literally a bookie window that allows these people to come in and throw all this money. And one of the ironies is there's a lot of pension fund monies in there. So the very people whose pensions are in there, they're the same people who go to the pump and get gouged.
Yes.
Isn't it crazy?
Yep. But the bottom line here is that this volatility in oil and gas and the high prices that working people have today in my state, you know, there is public transportation is very limited. So for people in a rural state to get to work, it is not uncommon that they have to travel 50 miles. You know, and if your paycheck has been stagnant, or in some cases actually has gone down in recent years, to have to pay, you know, $3.80 or $4 for a gallon of gas really, really hurts because you're struggling right now to keep above water. Furthermore, we worry in cold weather states about what happens in the wintertime for senior citizens who are heating with oil and what high prices will mean to them. So this is a very serious issue, and you're right. It impacts more than just gas and more than just oil per se. It impacts many other sectors of our society, and it is one of the reasons, I think, that has made it that much harder to see some real lift in getting out of this recession.
Well, isn't this where the rubber meets the road, Senator Sanders, in terms of this economy? And we have the former chief economist in the Reagan administration going public this week in the Financial Times, Larry Summers, saying we have a sick economy and we're facing a lost decade as the Japanese did. And we have not just the oil supplies squeeze and the food supply squeeze that is slowing down the recovery. You've got the Eurozone question about Greek debt. You've got the state and local debt situation. You've got another housing slump. And then you've got a slowdown in Asia with the Chinese growth engine.
Not to mention what's going on in Japan and their economy because of the nuclear disaster.
So somebody's got to step up to the plate here.
And... Well, here's where we're at. We have got to understand, you know, Summers is right, although ironically he is one of the policy guys who both under Clinton and Obama has helped develop policies that I think have helped create this type of situation. But be that as it may, we have to recognize that we are in a very, very serious economic moment, that the middle class is collapsing, poverty is increasing, and the gap between the very, very rich and everybody else is growing wider. So when we talk about the economics of the moment, ordinary people are hurting, but the people on top and the largest corporations are doing phenomenally well, and that's an issue that has to be addressed. The second issue is that when you talk about the economy and unemployment, please understand that real unemployment is a lot higher than official unemployment. The official unemployment is at 9%. Real unemployment is probably 15 to 16% if you include people who have given up looking for work, people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. So we got a real disaster on our hands for minorities. The numbers are just off the charts for younger people. Many older workers have lost the jobs they had and have new jobs that are paying substantially less than the jobs they previously had. And we need some bold thinking to get us out of it. And the bold thinking is not the Republican plan to move toward deficit reduction on the backs of the middle class and working families by ending Medicare as we know it, or making devastating cuts in Medicaid, education, nutrition programs, etc. I think the bold ideas is to go forward with deficit reduction in a way that is fair, which asks the wealthiest people in this country, whose tax rates are now very, very low, to start paying their fair share of taxes, and the offshoring of huge amounts of money in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, where people are avoiding perhaps $100 billion a year in revenue into the United States, and all of the loopholes that enable corporations to make billions in profits and not pay a nickel in taxes, GE among many others. And then at the same time, go forward aggressively with a real jobs program, which among other things would include rebuilding our infrastructure, which is in disastrous shape, roads, bridges, public transportation, water systems, transforming our energy system, and dealing with our trade policies, which frankly, in my view, have been a disaster, encouraging companies to move abroad and throw American workers out on the street. So you're right in saying these are very, very, very desperate times. It requires bold thinking, and I'm not sure we're getting it. We're certainly not getting it from our Republicans who want to get back to Herbert Hoover economics, and I don't think we're quite getting the leadership that we need from the president as well.
Well, just in closing, Senator Sanders, do you think the shot across the bow from Summers, albeit somewhat a discredited figure, nevertheless, the sense of alarm there and the fact that we're completely having the wrong debate? We have a revenue crisis. We don't have a deficit crisis. And this debt ceiling is a completely absurd and extraneous argument. So when are we going to get serious about the serious situation?
Well, but, Ian, you know, you have to understand our Republican friends are serious, and they are doing exactly what their wealthy backers want them to do. And people have got to understand that these are serious people, and they're not crazy. What they want to do is end the concept that government should be there to protect the needs of ordinary Americans.
But ordinary Americans pay their taxes. The rich don't pay their taxes.
Well, I know that, but their job, the Republicans' job, is to protect the rich. I mean, in the midst of the so-called Ryan deficit reduction plan, I know people think that I'm not telling the truth. Just check it out, because it sounds so crazy. After ending Medicare as we know it, which means that the elderly people will get far inferior health care at a much greater cost, after decimating Medicaid, which means that if you have a parent in a nursing home right now, you're going to have to come up with a significant part of that cost that Medicaid is now paying. After devastating environmental protection, nutrition, education, they want to give, over a 10-year period, $1 trillion more in tax breaks for the wealthiest people and the largest corporations.
Tim Pawlenty wants to give more.
Yeah, right.
It's crazy.
But this is so crazy, so off the charts, so far beyond what the American people believe. Every single poll that's been out there in terms of deficit reduction says, first of all, the first issue that people are concerned about is the economy and whether they're going to have a job. Second issue may be deficit reduction. And when you talk about that, what people are saying everywhere is there has to be shared sacrifice. You can't move toward deficit reduction solely on the backs of working families, the sick, the elderly, the children. You've got to ask the wealthy and large corporations to play a role. Republicans don't want them to contribute one nickel. the issue that we're in now. I mean, it's easy to beat up on the Republicans because their position is so absurd, so really incomprehensible. The issue is, will the Democratic leadership and the president stand tall? And we're working very hard to try to get them to simply do what the American people want and say, wait a minute, if we go to deficit reduction, there has to be shared sacrifice. At least half of deficit reduction must require the wealthiest people, large corporations, to start paying their fair share by ending all of the loopholes that currently exist. That's the fight of the moment, and it's a very, very important fight.
Well, thank you for joining us and letting us know what the fight is about. I appreciate it very much, Senator Sanders.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who's the senator from Vermont. He was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006. He's after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and he, along with the Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal and Bill Nelson of Florida, held a press conference today to introduce legislation to stop the excessive oil speculations that's driving up the price of gasoline and, incidentally, food as well. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll go to Athens in a moment and fill in a little bit of the picture that I was talking with the senator about, the possibility of Greece defaulting and how much it's already affected the markets here in the United States.
Come on now, who do you think you are? Ha, ha, bless your soul. You really think you're in control?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with John Brady Keesling, who worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States Department of State. He resigned publicly in protest of the damage done to U.S. interests and alliances by the Bush administration's foreign policy, particularly the war in Iraq. He was serving in Greece at the time and is now living in Greece. And his latest book is Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. It's evening or night in Athens. How far are you away from the tear gas?
We're at a safe distance at the moment. The tear gas seems to have blown the other direction, fortunately. We're about a 5-10 minute walk away. Did have to spend some time this evening rescuing our little dumpster, which they were going to use for a barricade and maybe set fire to, but we've got that back.
The people on the street are protesting the austerity measures that the socialist government are trying to push through to satisfy the European Union's demands on the Greek debt and the necessity to reduce spending. But at the same time, the conservative Greek government that got the country into this mess, they're not cooperating in any way, and the socialist government are losing their slim majority in order to pass these measures, as unpopular as they are. Is that a summary?
It's a good summary. The conservatives desperately want PASOK, the Socialist Party, to pass the measures, get them done, and be crucified by the voters afterwards. And their big fear is that the government will collapse and there will be early elections, which they would win with a tiny majority, but not enough to govern, but enough to give them the responsibility for the mess that follows. So it's an interesting dance.
The people on the street, some of them must be sophisticated to see this, or are they just so angry about their lives being downsized?
Basically, they are angry enough not to care about the consequences. And this is dangerous because historically what happens when you overthrow a well-meaning but not very effective government, the people who take over are complete sharks and parasites. And we've got enough of those circling now to make me nervous.
So you think there could be a kind of right-wing fascist group waiting in the wings?
The European Union, I think, is having to look very seriously at the idea of essentially taking over the country and running it for a while, because the only alternative to that is a brief left-wing resurgence followed by a far-right-wing nationalist backlash that will be extremely ugly.
And John Brady Keesling,
I think it's a real danger.
Again, I'm speaking with John Brady Keesling, who worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States Department of State. He was in the U.S. Embassy in Athens at the time. He resigned publicly in protest over the war in Iraq, and he's the author of Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. The long and the short of what's happening in Greece seems to be, at least in terms of this crisis, you may not know, Brady, that it's affecting the U.S. stock exchange today. It's taking a major dip. And a lot of the insecurities because of a leak of a U.S. EU commissioner's memo saying that they've got profound sense of foreboding about Greece. And, of course, the bond markets are smelling blood. And Standard & Poor's has cut the Greek sovereign debt to CCC rating, which is the lowest of any rating in the world. So what's the local reaction to these realities?
People are scared. People are angry. People want to lash out at someone. People have essentially gone back to tribal attitudes, a theory that if we all hang together and fight for whatever it is that we won over the past 30 years, we will be able to hold it. And unfortunately, I think the balance of power, perhaps the economic reality, is totally against Greece at the moment. Greece is intrinsically a poor country, and it's going to be, for the next few years, a poor country. The question is, how do you do the reforms? The current government has not been able to articulate a vision that people accept. The opposition has been worse than useless, and we now have a major vacuum in political leadership, which the people on the street are trying to fill, but they've got no ideas.
Well, my understanding is that the situation is that the creditors of Greece are expecting the government, through austerity measures, to start paying down their debt. And the real question is whether anybody believes that Greece is capable of paying back its debt. And apparently the financial markets are losing faith in that possibility. Now, how can Greece pay down its debt if you're squeezing more blood out of the stone in terms of people's income? And my understanding is one of the reasons why you have this problem in the first place is that most Greeks don't pay taxes. So how do you get revenues?
It's very difficult to get revenues. The state is profoundly dysfunctional. For decades, higher has a basically political decision. The two major parties have used it to build their electoral clientele, and the civil service is very large. They can't pay people quite enough, to be honest. The civic morality at this point is very low. So you have essentially socialism without a spirit of sort of social solidarity to make it work. And it has been a disaster. It's not sustainable, but fixing it requires people with vision and also some patience from the creditors. But at this point, as you say, people smell blood in the water. They think there's going to be a default. People are pushing as hard as they can to make sure they get their money out and someone else is holding the bag.
So it's quite possible, Brady Keesling, that before the full meeting of the 27 EU prime ministers and presidents that takes place on June the 23rd and 24th, that this crisis could overcome the EU's ability to deal with it.
I think that's realistic. Prime Minister George Papandreou has already called his old college roommate from the United States, Tony Samaras, the head of the conservative opposition New Democracy Party, and offered a government of cooperation of both parties with someone else as prime minister. This is a sign of desperation. Of course, Samaras is looking at this offer saying, no, we don't really want to be tainted by the collapse of the Greek state. We'd like to stay out of it unless you make it a really good deal for us. But that attitude is not enough to pull Greece out of the crisis.
Well, you know, that sounds a little bit like what's happening here in the United States, where you have a financial crisis caused during the Bush administration, the previous administration, caused by deregulation and free market fundamentalism and criminality. And the Obama administration, the Democrats, are stuck with this mess, and the Republicans have not helped them from day one. And the Republicans are counting on the economy getting so bad that they'll get reelected, or that they'll take over the Senate and the White House and have the trifecta in 2012. Isn't that what the Greek conservatives are doing? They caused the mess, and they're sitting on their hands, and they're letting the other side go down with a sinking ship.
But in Greece, the conservatives are even more unpopular than George W. Bush became. At the moment, less than half of the public says it's willing to vote for one of the two major parties, you know, Socialist PASOK or Conservative New Democracy. They don't say who they are voting for, but there's a far-right party that's sounding responsible. You've got a couple of left parties which are, you know, which think, oh my God, the revolution is coming, let's pull up our socks and get to work. And it's frightening because there is, the people on the street do not support the politicians generally. They are looking for another solution. And historically, the solution they find, or the solution that is handed to them, is not the one they want, like the Islamic Revolution in Iran, or the the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, where a small group of fanatics takes over, mostly greedy fanatics. I think that's going to happen here. I'm very, very upset with how things are playing out.
Well, Brady Keesling, I thank you for joining us here and filling us in. You know, we hear warnings here that the United States is heading for Greece, but people don't recognize, I think, how Greece got into this situation. Basically,
there's no such thing as easy money, and a government that is not willing to be honest to the voters and make sensible sacrifices early is a government that's going to lead to, you know, to destruction. And that's what we've got here. We've seen it in the U.S., in California, with the financial crisis. And I hope we can take the lesson from Greece, but I think Greece is in for 10 years of very tough sledding.
And it's worth noting that Goldman Sachs helped hide Greece's sovereign debt through financial manipulation, and now the chickens are coming home to roost. So
that's right.
There's a lot of blame to go around.
Of course, and a lot of people made a lot of money in the process of walking Greece over the cliff. And those people are not going to give that money back.
Well, I thank you for joining us from Athens, Greece, this evening, John Brady Keesling.
Well, my pleasure. Good luck back home.
Well, I think you need it more than I do. I thank you again. John Brady Keesling worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States State Department in Athens, Greece, in the embassy, the U.S. embassy there. He resigned publicly to protest the Iraq war, and his most recent book is Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a spokesperson for Planned Parenthood who had their funds stripped today by the legislature in North Carolina. And welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm speaking with Melissa Reed, who is the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood Health Systems in North Carolina. She's speaking to us from the Capitol in Raleigh, where today the legislature and the Senate overrode the governor's veto, which will strip Planned Parenthood of all state and federal money, making North Carolina the third state in a row to defund the nation's foremost family planning provider. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melissa Reed.
Thank you for having me.
And clearly this has been a tough day, and I understand that there's yet another anti-abortion bill that's being debated as we speak.
That's correct. It's what we've called an abortion omnibus bill, and it will have numerous onerous restrictions for a woman's access to care.
So let's go through the what happened today, Melissa. The governor, Democratic governor, Bev Perdue, vetoed the state budget, which had these riders on to strip funding from Planned Parenthood in the name of banning abortions. And the House overrode it, and then later the Senate. And now they're voting on another even more onerous anti-abortion bill. But dealing with the consequences of your organization, what is this going to mean?
Well, the budget included state and federal funding, or the ban in the budget included state and federal funding of just about $434,000 that goes completely for family planning care for low-income men and women in North Carolina, breast and cervical cancer screening, and teen pregnancy prevention. And so the impact is going to be felt most keenly by those uninsured and underinsured men and women who no longer have access to a trusted provider.
But this was done as an anti-abortion measure, and the money that's being cut has nothing to do with abortion, right?
That's correct. It has absolutely nothing to do with abortion. We're prohibited from using any of those funds for abortion. And yet the majority leader in the House stated very clearly that this provision was put in there to punish Planned Parenthood because of the abortion care they provide otherwise.
But did anybody point out to this politician that the real effect will be to punish a lot of women, particularly poor women?
We certainly pointed that out many times. In fact, in many of our counties, there's a 12-week wait. In one county, there's as much as a 14-week wait right now at the health department for a woman to get birth control or a pap smear. And they are not putting any money in there to lift that burden from the health department. And so those weeks, those waits are going to increase by many weeks for these men and women.
And I take it, though, that the people that will really be impacted by these cuts are teen pregnancy prevention and adolescent parenting programs. And this is going to force low-income patients to pay out of pocket. Again, I take it these arguments were made, but they fell on deaf ears.
They were very clearly made, and we pointed out that really if you care about reducing the need for abortion, then you should be absolutely investing in teen pregnancy prevention and contraceptive care. And they were so driven by their own ideology that they were unable to support that.
Again, I'm speaking with Melissa Reed, who is the Vice President of Public Policy at Planned Parenthood Health Systems in North Carolina. She's speaking to us from the Capitol in Raleigh, where today the legislature and the Senate overrode the governor's veto, thus stripping Planned Parenthood of all state and federal money in North Carolina. Of course, North Carolina being now the third state in a row after Indiana and Kansas to Planned Parenthood to suffer from these Republican efforts to defund them, all of which being done in the name of anti-abortion rhetoric, or what do you call it? I mean, it seems to me almost an obsession. But the long and the short of it is that there does seem to be a coordinated strategy here, because these efforts were made at the federal level recently, and they failed narrowly. And it looks as though there's a coordinated effort on the part of Republicans to introduce this, the same measures at a state level. And you're just the third duck in a row.
That's right. It's unprecedented. In our state, this is the first time a health care provider has ever been singled out in the budget. Our allies in the House pointed out that this was a bill of attainder. It was a way to punish an entity and that it was unconstitutional. And yet again, they just drove their anti-choice beliefs forward without paying any mind to reality.
Well, but how about the truth, though? This is what I particularly find disgraceful. These people call themselves good Christians, right? And Representative Pat McElrath, she told her colleagues in the House this very tearful story about how a nephew and his girlfriend experienced this terrible thing with Planned Parenthood 14 years ago, and they were told that she was going to have a deformed baby because of a drug use, and her only option was abortion, and they went into some dark, dank room in some house somewhere, and turns out the whole thing was made up.
Well,
it wasn't totally made up, but...
It was really an error of omission by not saying... where and when this incident happened. She also alluded to it happening at Planned Parenthood throughout her entire speech. And when we confronted her afterwards, she admitted that it was not at a Planned Parenthood. She admitted that it was in Georgia and over 14 years ago. And so we called her out on that. We said, why would you, you know, continue to defame Planned Parenthood and pass bad policy in this state based on something that happened over a decade ago to state south.
And had nothing to do with Planned Parenthood?
Nothing to do with Planned Parenthood.
So what was her response?
She said her intent was not to mislead the General Assembly, that the things that she said were in fact true. Just because she didn't tell the whole story didn't make it untrue.
Well, what do you do now, Melissa? Because I noticed in Indiana there was a substantial reaction of outrage from people, and money started to pour in. But of course, that's not the same as, I mean, what's amazing about this is not just the state funds, but the federal funds that are being cut as well.
Right, and we even had allies offer amendments to say, well, at least let them allow to have federal pass-through dollars. And you don't have to match it with state. And they would not even allow just federal pass-through dollars. So the options we have, of course, is, you know, we're considering potential litigation. We are also amping up our fundraising efforts so that we can continue to reach out and provide low-cost birth control and family planning to these families in need, but we're really considering a variety of options at this point.
So do you have any, or does your organization know exactly who's coordinating all of this throughout these states? I mean, it's just the bills are identical. The same thing's happening with these restrictions on voting, voter ID requirements, and reducing the time for absentee balloting. We know that in the case of these identical Republican initiatives in many of these same states that in many ways are being coordinated by a group with an acronym, ALEC, which is funded by the Koch brothers. Do you have any idea of who's coordinating all these state legislatures with these efforts? And now they have 1, 2, 3, Indiana, Kansas, and now North Carolina.
I do not know who's coordinating on a national level. Here in North Carolina, the GOP majority leader, Representative Paul Stamm, is the driver between his anti-choice legislation and also dismantling public schools. But I think he's working with a lot of conservative think tanks, including the John Locke Foundation and Civitas.
Well, but the point, I guess, here is that elections have consequences, right? This state still has a Democratic governor, and she's doing the best she can, but her veto was overridden. She doesn't have a line item veto, so the whole budget was being held up. The state in the last elections, the Republicans got an enormous sweep, didn't they?
They did. It was unbelievable, actually, what happened in North Carolina in November of 2010. Previous to that election, we had had a Democratic majority in our state legislature for a century, literally 100 years since the Senate had been Republican. And as a result, North Carolina had been a leader in public education and also family planning. We were one of the few states in the nation to have not passed any restrictions to reproductive health care in over a decade before this year.
So, but just to get an understanding about the idea that you have some new blood after 100 years, maybe that's not a bad idea, but I thought the Republicans stood for fiscal responsibility and other things, but it seems like their priorities are making sure that minority people don't vote and going after health care for women. Is that fair? What priorities have they shown in this new legislature?
Well, I think you spelled it out pretty clearly that the voters elected these people to focus on jobs and the economy. And instead, they have spent almost all of their time passing legislation to suppress voters, to suppress access to reproductive health care, and to dismantle public education. And the budget bill also went further to create massive layoffs in our educational system and to dismantle our environmental and natural resources protections and agencies.
Well, Melissa Reed, I thank you for joining us here today. I'm sorry, it's a sad day for me, and I'm not even there. It must be a terrible day for you.
It has been very, very disappointing and a sad day indeed for North Carolina.
Again, I've been speaking with Melissa Reed, who's the Vice President of Public Policy for Planned Parenthood Health Systems in North Carolina. And let's now turn to another story in the news, which is pretty shocking as well, and that is ATF agents were told to stand aside as hundreds of guns were sold to Mexican drug cartels, with two of these guns under ATF surveillance ending up at the scene of the fatal shooting of Border Patrol agent Brian Terry. We're now joined by a former ATF agent, Special Agent Gerald Nunziata, who is a partner in the firm Crime Gun Solutions. He is a former Special Agent of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, where among other duties he served as a Firearms Interdiction Program Manager and a Special Agent in charge of ATF's National Tracing Center. He is an internationally recognized expert on tracing guns used in crimes. In essence, he developed the techniques now used to trace gun crimes. And, of course, we're very familiar with these, Gerald, from these CSI shows on television. And you developed that technology. So what do you make of the hearing today in the Congress and the outrages that was expressed about the ATF standing aside while these guns were shipped to the Mexican cartels, two of whom ended up killing a Border Patrol agent?
Well, as I listened to the conversation and read the report, there was a constant theme through the whole thing. They couldn't prove anything was illegal. They even said that, in the report, the agent said that they made the gun purchases legally, but then they were illegal purchases. In our laws, under our government, anybody could go into a gun store and buy as many guns as they want and walk out of the store. There's nothing illegal about that. And what you do with the guns, that's your personal business, as long as you don't cross state lines and dispose of them. So you could go into a gun store, buy 1,000 guns, and a day later you could go to a gun show and sell them to anybody that would pay you money for them. And there's nothing really illegal about that.
So Congressman Darrell Issa, in charge of this oversight committee, he's a Republican from just south of here, So he's just posturing. I mean, in other words, the real problem is the Congress itself in not
I worked in South Florida on gun running to South America and to New York and up north, and we would have to follow the guns from the gun store to a customs warehouse where they turn them over to ship overseas before we could take any action. Or we actually had to follow them from Miami to New York City and actually see the purchaser hand the guns over to somebody who was not a resident of Florida. When they use this word straw purchaser, it's a very, very difficult thing to prove. You have to prove that that person went into the gun store to buy a gun for a specific person, and that person gave them the money and instructed them what guns to buy. Just because somebody went into a gun store and bought guns and went to somebody else's house and supposedly turned the guns over to them, that doesn't meet the definition of a probable cause. In fact, some things they alluded to, they wanted to grab guns. The NRA would have had a heart attack if we started grabbing guns, if people buying them out of gun stores or walking out of gun stores with them.
So what was the point of this Operation Fast and Furious?
Historically, you know, going back even when I was an agent in the 90s, guns from the south border always ended up in Mexico or South America. And we've always tried to stop the flow of gun. But every time we did, they would change and weaken the laws to give ATF less power, and it gave the gun dealers more power. There were several things in that congressional report that were illegal, according to the Tiahrt Amendment that was put in by the gun lobby to allow ATF to share information to other jurisdictions.
Explain the Tiahrt. Gerald Nunziata, explain the Tiahrt Amendment to our audience, because it seems so counterintuitive that these guns that end up, and you're the one that developed the technology, they end up being crime guns, and people are being killed by these guns, but the information can't be shared with other law enforcement?
No, the Tiahrt Amendment only allows you to get information you submitted by your department or what they call regional information if you could identify a bona fide investigation, which is very unique because there's no definition of what a bona fide investigation is. In fact, the NRA up in Cleveland mentioned that the guns going to Mexico are not coming from the United States because they said they have information from ATF that it was a misnomer that the guns are coming from the United States. I give you one example. When I worked at ATF, New York City police sold all their used guns, and a couple of them turned up in homicides. And the state of New York immediately prevented the sale of used police guns. They would give the states, the cities money to have them destroyed. And the gun lobby screamed and hollered and said, you can't do that. So anytime there was kind of a reaction to stop these obvious loopholes, they're always stopped. And I feel bad for ATF.
Well, but isn't the story of ATF is that they're always being defunded, that the Congress cuts their funds so that they can't computerize their records, they're forced isn't that the game that's played?
Well, just a couple of years ago, the ATF agents tried to interdict illegal gun sales at a gun show in Virginia, and they were brought before a congressional committee because how dare they surveil American citizens buying guns at a gun show? Now, anybody could go without any identification. They're not demonstrating this, and even the mayors against illegal guns have demonstrated this all over the country, but they refuse to shut down this loophole. And it's even what they're doing down there on the south border, look at all the gun dealers down there that moved in down there. And in this report, they only indicted one or two people. It just doesn't make sense that they're saying this is all illegal, but there was no laws broken. Even the U.S. attorney said there were no show me a law that was being broken.
Well, but the study's been done, though. This is the part of the so extraordinary. Again, I speak with Gerald Nunziata, who was the Firearms Interdiction Program Manager at the 8 Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and now it's Explosives as well. And he was a special agent in charge of the ATF's National Tracing Center. He developed a technology that's used to trace crime guns. Senator Feinstein and Schumer and Sheldon Whitehouse have issued a report from the United States Senate Caucus on International Narcotics Control. This just came out. And they have done this exhaustive study, and they're pretty much proving that of about the 35,000 people who've died by organized crime-related killings in Mexico, about 60% of the deaths, from the which is up 60% from the last year, that most of the firearms are coming from the United States. I mean, the proof is there. So,
well, no, the proof is that the guns are turning up in Mexico. What they're lacking is proving what laws were broken at the gun dealer.
I see. So,
like, you could go into the gun dealer and buy a gun, and a week later, say, I'm going to Mexico, I'm going to bring it with me. Now, what law was broken? The law wasn't broken until you crossed the border.
I see.
Now, even if you had intent to do that, how do you prove that? You got to prove the intent by undercover operations, by getting informants, and or even getting cooperative gun dealers. And it's very difficult because the laws aren't there saying that you bought a gun and it turned up in Mexico that you should be tried or accused of a crime.
Well, you know, this is not coming out. What you're telling us is not clear from the way this story is being reported. The story is being reported as though this is another example of government bureaucrats sitting on their hands, and that they, you know, they're castigating the congressman today. We're castigating the ATF oversight people who had oversight over this operation, this surveillance operation, who apparently were told by their bosses that they couldn't interdict these guns. And the answer is, the reason they couldn't interdict these guns is that the laws are absolutely useless because the Congress is in the pocket of the NRA and have made sure that there aren't any effective laws.
Well, you know, they made in their statements that they wanted to stop the people coming out of the gun shows and grab their guns. My God, that's what ATF was known as back in the 70s. They stopped our budget because they thought we were going to, quote, grab guns. Or they inferred that, well, if we stopped and talked to those straw purchasers, they wouldn't do it again. But then later on, they admitted that the people knew they were surveilling them, and they still went and bought the guns. Because the people that are buying these guns know the laws are so weak that it would you almost feel sorry for the guy that gets caught doing something illegal.
Yeah, I'm just going through this very thick report of Senator Feinstein's that was just issued by the Senate caucus international narcotics control, and apparently the figure is of the nearly 30,000 firearms recovered in 2009 and 2010 in Mexico, where gun possession is illegal, some 70% were determined to have come from the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not arguing that.
Sure.
I'm saying that's a very true statement, but you can't, what could, there's no laws that prevent it. The only laws you would have is smuggling guns across the border. It's not at the gun dealer where the first is purchasing. They have to go through a background investigation to buy these guns.
So if ATF has no political support or little political support, and they're constantly beaten up by the NRA or by the congressman in the pocket of the NRA, what about the Border Patrol? They just lost their Border Patrol agent, Brian Terry, who was killed by these guns that were purchased in the border states and ended up with the Mexican cartels.
You're right. They should be more interactive, but the TR Amendment may prevent them from doing it.
I see.
Because if a Border Patrol officer in California comes across a gun, he can't determine that this guy had 50 other gun traces from other jurisdictions because the TR Amendment kind of prevents that unless he could demonstrate he has a bona fide investigation to look into the history of all these other guns. And to be honest with you, he would have a hard time coming up with that idea because he seized one gun. And give you an example of a TR Amendment that when I was an agent with the Tracing Center, 200,000 times when I was under my career, we feared that the gun dealer was going to provide information to criminals that were involved with gun trafficking. We had special codes we put into the
Well, well, I'm sorry we've run out of time. I would love to get the rest of this story, but I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Yeah.
Gerald Nunziato, again, he designed all of these tracing methods in gun crimes, former special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. So let's do a wrap-up on today's background briefing. We started out with Senator Bernie Sanders, who was very passionate about how the price of gas and food are being gouged and driven by speculators, and he's introduced legislation today to try and stop this. It's in a broader context of what he feels is a country that is of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich, and that the middle class are getting shafted. He doesn't think, he thinks when I suggested that was critical of the Republicans, he said, no, the Republicans are quite rational. They're not crazy. They're doing exactly what they want to do, which is take care of the rich, which is what they do. He laid more of the fault at the Democrats for not stepping up to the plate and standing up for the working Americans and the American middle class. Then we went to Athens, Greece to talk to an American diplomat who quit in protest over the Iraq war. He still lives in Greece. He was with the U.S. Embassy there. And he is within a couple of minutes of where the tear gas is. And his prognosis about what's happening in Greece was pretty bleak. The people on the street are just so angry. They don't care about the big picture. They're furious with their own government who's trying to squeeze these austerity measures. The conservatives are sitting back to waiting for the government to fall, but they're even more unpopular than the socialists. And the long and the short of it, nobody pays taxes in Greece. Nobody wants to take responsibility. And it is truly going to hell in a handbasket. He thinks it's not a question of when, it's not a question of if, but when Greece defaults on its debt and descends into chaos. And already that was indicated by a leak from a European Union email that where they privately expressed doubts that Greece was ever going to pay back its debts. And as soon as that leak came out, the U.S. stock market went in tank today. And clearly, the bond market, of course, smells blood in the water, and they're just pounding the Greek bonds. Then we spoke with the representative of Planned Parenthood in North Carolina. She's had a miserable day because the legislature down there, the new Republican legislature, first in 100 years, overturned the Democratic governor's veto of a budget that had stripped out the funds for Planned Parenthood. They overrode the veto, so Planned Parenthood has lost its funds in North Carolina. This is the third state in a row after Indiana and Kansas, and is a part of a general, broader national strategy. Then finally, we talked to a special agent from the ATF, the guy that developed gun tracing from gun crimes, about this insane situation where guns go from the southern states into Mexico. Some of these guns ended up killing a border patrolman, yet there's nothing they can do about it because the laws are written by the NRA. This program is available at ianmasters.com, where you can also check out my blog. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassida and assistant producer Ian Rowe. I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now.